Today is Thursday, October 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden aren't having their second debate tonight, but each will be making their case to the American public.
Biden will appear tonight on an ABC town hall and the president on NBC at the very same time.
Plus, new restrictions in Thailand as protests continue and September records record temperatures. All of these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden will appear tonight in dueling town halls instead of a formal debate as originally scheduled. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
There won't be any of this.
The radical question, left.
Will you shut up, man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
No repeat of their hostile first debate. Tonight was to be the second debate, but President Trump refused to do it virtually after his COVID-19 diagnosis, so the debate commission scrapped it. Biden will appear tonight on an ABC town hall and the president on NBC at the very same time, forcing viewers to pick which candidate to watch instead of seeing them interact with the election fewer than 3 weeks away. Critics wonder why NBC is forcing viewers to choose between the two. While their first debate drew an estimated 73 million viewers, according to Nielsen ratings, far fewer people are expected to see the two candidates tonight. Roughly 10.5 million saw them both during the last ABC and NBC town halls. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Biden campaign says that vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris will suspend in-person events through Monday after two people associated with the campaign have tested positive for the coronavirus. The Biden campaign says that Harris was tested negative for the coronavirus on Wednesday and was not in close contact with the aide under CDC guidelines. This week, the United States Senate is holding confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill the Supreme Court seat left empty by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who passed away last month. Supreme Court justices are lifetime positions that hold great power, and the battle to fill the seat has become a focus of the contest between President Trump and his challenger, Joe Biden. Patsy Witikuswara has that story.
Protesters and supporters of Amy Coney Barrett square off outside of the Supreme Court as the conservative judge faces tough questions from Senate Democrats, including whether she will recuse herself from cases that could impact the outcome of the November election.
I will apply the factors that other justices have before me in determining whether the circumstances require my recusal or not. But I can't offer a legal conclusion right now about the outcome of the decision I would reach.
Appointment of conservative judges is a key campaign promise for President Donald Trump, who often frames it in ideological terms.
If Joe Biden and the Democrats take power, they will pack the Supreme Court with far-left radicals who will unilaterally transform American society far beyond recognition.
Currently behind in opinion polls, Trump frequently claims the only way he will lose against Democratic nominee Joe Biden is if the election is rigged. With dozens of election-related lawsuits already filed, close results in swing states could mean a scenario like the 2000 race between George W. Bush and Al Gore, where the result was decided by a Supreme Court vote. Statements by Trump and some Republicans suggesting that Barrett must be confirmed to ensure the court rules in their favor in post-election litigation creates the appearance of impropriety, said constitutional expert Adam White.
They have really created a cloud that I think she is going to have to dispel through her own work on the court to make very clear that when she's appointed to the court, that she doesn't answer to President Trump. She doesn't answer to anybody but the law.
If Barrett is confirmed, there will be six justices appointed by Republican presidents and three appointed by Democrats. If Biden wins, some Democrats want him to appoint more Supreme Court justices, arguing that it would help ideologically balance the court. Republicans strongly oppose that. The number of justices is not set in the Constitution, but there have been nine since 1869. Adam White, American Enterprise Institute scholar.
If you add more and more seats, you're going to have small coalitions that have to engage in sort of compromise and I won't say bartering, but it'll look less and less like a principled body of decisions and more like a set of legislative compromises.
Biden says he's not a fan of court packing, but has largely avoided the issue, focusing instead on Democrats' concern that the court could overturn a signature Obama-era legislation that expands Americans' access to health care.
This nominee said she wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. The president wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act.
Barrett insisted that if confirmed, she has no agenda on Obamacare or other politically divisive issues, including abortion rights and same-sex marriage. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The United States mediated the opening round of indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel over their disputed maritime border on Wednesday. Both sides insisted that the talks are purely technical and not a sign of normalization. But Israel has said that there will be direct negotiations, which Lebanese officials have denied. Lebanon and Israel are technically in a state of war, and the talks are the first between the two countries in 30 years. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the sensitive event with Joe Macaron, a senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington.
Ultimately, I think we have a clear breakthrough here because both sides, for the first time, are agreeing to negotiate a final border agreement. However, this took 10 years, basically, to get to this framework agreement. There was a lot of differences regarding forms and substance of the talks. The Lebanese side wanted rather military technical delegation and talks. The Israeli and U.S. side was trying to have more a political dimension, rather civilians negotiating in the room. So it was somehow a mixture in the talks on October 14. It's not clear how the U.S. mediated. Was it relaying messages or not? The Lebanese side insisted to have a low-profile meeting. There was no media allowed in the room. So there's a lot of sensitive nature of this talk, especially on the Lebanese side. And the U.S., after pressuring Lebanese politicians to start these talks, they were more understanding at this point to focus on the talks. And we'll see what will happen, but at least in the form, I think it was a formula that was agreed by everyone and didn't make the Lebanese side very uncomfortable in these talks.
Hezbollah and its ally Amal criticized the formation of the Lebanese delegation for including civilian politicians, and pro-Hezbollah media called the talks a moment of unprecedented political weakness of Lebanon. What's your take on that?
Obviously, Amal and Hezbollah are playing for their domestic politics. They took this decision for the talks to happen, and it makes them a little bit uncomfortable with their base. So they keep on the pressure on President Aoun, as the U.S. also is keeping the pressure on President Aoun, since he became now the main negotiator on the Lebanese side after Birrin, the Speaker of the Parliament, gave up this portfolio when the talks already started. The talks are ongoing. There's another meeting on October 28. And what matters is the Hezbollah gave a green light for these talks to proceed. And whatever we see moving forward is part of the theatrics for Lebanese consumption.
Lebanon and Israel are technically in a state of war, and the talks are the first between the two countries in 30 years. What prompted Lebanon to participate in the talks at this time? And would an agreement mediated by the U.S. help the troubled economic situation in Lebanon?
This U.S. mediation has been going on for 10 years. It took them a while in the last few years to issue this framework agreement. I think after the Beirut explosion on August 4th, Lebanon became more vulnerable to external pressure. And the Lebanese politician wanted to avoid further U.S. sanctions because the U.S. sanctioned a close aid of Nabih Birri before reaching this framework agreement. So I think the Lebanese tactic was to avoid pressure, announce a non-binding framework agreement, and allow these talks to proceed and basically buy time. A second motivation also is Lebanon in a very dire economic situation, and they need to unlock some of the gas revenues to basically mitigate this economic impact, cut little of the national debt. So also this was part of the calculation that this Lebanese system cannot survive anymore without having another source of revenue. So all those factors, I think, play in. Doesn't mean if the framework agreement started, doesn't mean we have a quick deal or any deal. This might take years and years, protracted negotiation at the technical level. But moving forward, I think the U.S. will continue to use the carrot and sticks to make sure that these talks are proceeding. But it will continue, I think, to play many cards to try to at least reach minimal agreement that will be accepted by all sides.
Joe Macaron is a senior fellow at the Arab Center, and he was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. Hong Kong media tycoon and pro-democracy activist Jimmy Lai said police raided his private offices earlier on Thursday, months after he was arrested on suspicion of violating the city's national security law.
The police didn't even wait for the lawyers to come before they took everything away. So that's not the rule of law. Yeah, and they did not leave their, the ballot. They didn't leave the ballot for us. They just took everything.
Lai's aide Mark Simon said on Twitter police did not leave any names or contacts for the 14 officers who searched the office. In addition, more than two dozen pro-democracy activists appeared at West Kowloon Magistrates Court in Hong Kong on Thursday as hearings resumed for cases of participating in an unlawful assembly. They are accused of offenses related to this year's annual candlelight vigil in memory of the 1989 Tiananmen crackdown in Beijing. Li Chuk-yan, a pro-democracy activist, said they would be undeterred by the charges.
The Hong Kong Alliance will be persistent in our right to mourn June 4th, and we will continue, even under the national security law next year, to light a candle inside the Quarry Park to condemn the massacre and mourn June 4th.
The defendants include some of the best-known democracy advocates in Hong Kong, including businessman Jimmy Lai and activist Joshua Wong. Still to come,
a small change in the mean of the global temperature can lead to big changes in extreme weather. And so what we're seeing right now is that we do expect for heat waves to become more frequent, more intense, and we're already seeing that in terms of drought as well. The general rule of thumb is that areas that are dry will get drier and areas that are wet will get wetter.
This is VOA News.
In a minute.
A team of astronomers led by Nobel laureate Adam Riess of the Space Telescope Science Institute and Johns Hopkins University used the Hubble Space Telescope to track and image a supernova for a year. Called SN 2018-GV, the supernova is described as a Type 1A supernova. Type 1A supernovas are used by astronomers to measure the expansion of the universe, something Riess and his team were doing when they tracked the supernova. The Hubble captured detailed images of the exploding star as it began as a very bright star until it faded into the darkness of interstellar space. According to the team, the supernova is in a barred spiral galaxy called NGC 2525, which is about 70 million light-years away in the constellation Puppis. If you want to take a look at the time-lapse video, visit spacetelescope.org. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Millions of people in Britain are waiting to find out whether they will be placed under the government's toughest COVID-19 restrictions as local leaders meet with senior government officials about efforts to slow the spread of the virus. The mayor of the Greater Manchester area with 2.8 million people says he expects to meet with Prime Minister Boris Johnson's team on Thursday for talks on whether the region will be classified as a high-risk area. Britain's health secretary has shifted London into the second highest COVID-19 alert level amid a rise in cases.
The central change is that people cannot now meet other households socially indoors. This applies in any setting, at home or in a restaurant or in any other venue. The rule of six still applies in any outdoor setting. And although you may continue to travel to open venues, you should reduce the number of journeys where possible. Now, I know that these measures are not easy, but I also know that they are vital. Mr. Speaker, responding to this unprecedented pandemic requires difficult choices, some of the most difficult choices any government has had to make in peacetime. We make these decisions with a heavy heart, with the sole aim of steering our nation through troubled waters. Things will get worse before they get better. But I know that there are brighter skies and calmer seas ahead, that the ingenuity of science will find a way through. And until then, we must come together, because we all have a part to play in defeating this dreadful disease.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan had earlier called for the restrictions to be put in place.
We're at a critical moment in our fight against COVID in London. The virus is spreading rapidly in every corner of our city. We'll soon reach an average of 100 cases per 100,000 people, with a significant number of boroughs already over that threshold. Hospital admissions are up, more patients are going to intensive care units, and sadly, the number of Londoners dying every day is increasing again.
There have been over 650,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Britain, according to statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. AP correspondent Laurie Hinnett reports that people in France have filed over 90 complaints in recent months, mainly due to shortages of masks and other equipment.
Well, the complaints are that the government willfully failed to provide enough protection for healthcare workers and failed to plan for a global pandemic that was known to be coming. This is a series of COVID patients plus healthcare workers and prison personnel, police officers, others who said they were uniquely vulnerable to the disease.
Globally, there have been more than 38.5 million cases of COVID-19, with nearly 8 million cases alone in the U.S. VOA has extended pandemic coverage on our website. After months of escalating protests in Thailand, the government instituted new restrictions Thursday. Reuters' Libby Hogan has the details.
Thailand woke up to a government ban on both protests and the publication of sensitive news on Thursday as emergency measures took effect at 4 a.m. It follows an escalation in protests that have targeted King Maha Vajiralongkorn as well as Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha. The government has justified the order, citing the obstruction of a royal motorcade, as well as the coronavirus, growing disorder and economic damage. Thousands of anti-government protesters marched to Government House on Wednesday, calling for a new constitution and for Prayut to resign, saying he manipulated an election last year, accusations which he says are untrue. As the emergency measures kicked in, riot police moved in on protesters camped outside Prayut's office. Police said they had arrested about 20 people who refused to cooperate, including two of the protest leaders, Pari Chirawat, known as Penguin, and human rights lawyer Anand Nampa. The ban also includes publishing news or online information that, quote, could create fear or affect national security. The protests that have continued for 3 months have put the greatest pressure in years on an establishment long dominated by the army and the palace.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. Armenia accused Turkey Thursday of blocking flights carrying emergency aid from using its airspace, and new fighting over the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave threatened to pitch the region into a humanitarian crisis. Azerbaijan and Armenia accused each other of violating a ceasefire brokered less than a week ago to enable the sides to swap detainees and the bodies of those killed in the clashes, which erupted on September 27th. The flare-up is the deadliest since the 1990s, when 30,000 people were killed in a war over Nagorno-Karabakh, a territory that is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan but governed by ethnic Armenians. Kyrgyzstan President Sooronbay Jeenbekov resigned Thursday after 10 days of unrest following a disputed election, saying he wanted to prevent clashes between security forces and protesters who have demanded his removal from office. Kyrgyzstan has been in turmoil since the October 4th parliamentary election, which the opposition rejected after the president's allies were declared the winners. On Wednesday, Jeenbekov accepted parliament's choice of Sadir Japarov to be prime minister. Japarov and his followers have demanded Jeenbekov leave office. The European Union on Thursday imposed sanctions on 6 Russian officials and 1 organization over the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny with a Soviet-era nerve agent. The move came a day after Russia's foreign minister warned that Moscow might respond with similar measures. On Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov suggested that Moscow might even sever ties. The decision was agreed upon among the 27 EU envoys to Brussels. September was hot. How hot? Reuters reporter Gloria So has that story.
From Siberia to South America, scorching temperatures around the world made last month the hottest September ever on record, according to scientists at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's drawing out a long-standing trend of global warming caused by emissions of heat-trapping gases. And scientists say the high temperatures have played a major role fueling the biggest environmental disasters this year, from the raging wildfires in California to the floods across Asia. NOAA climatologist Ahiro Sanchez Lugo says there's a good chance this could be the hottest year on record.
A small change in the mean of the global temperature can lead to big changes in extreme weather. And so what we're seeing right now is that we do expect for heat waves to become more frequent, more intense, and we're already seeing that in terms of drought as well. The general rule of thumb is that areas that are dry will get drier and areas that are wet will get wetter.
Under the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, countries across the globe agreed to attempt to cap global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, which scientists say would avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. Even though large emitters like China and the European Union have pledged to slash their emissions in the coming decades, current policies would still see temperatures rise far beyond the 1.5 degree level.
That was Reuters' Gloria So. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A United Nations independent international fact-finding mission on Venezuela report released in September concluded that there are reasonable grounds to believe that crimes against humanity, including the crimes against humanity of murder, imprisonment, torture, enforced disappearances, and rape and other forms of sexual violence, were committed in Venezuela. Even more disturbing, the UN report says it has reasonable grounds to believe that both the president and the ministers of People's Power for Interior Relations, Justice and Peace, and for Defense ordered or contributed to the commission of these crimes documented in this report. In other words, these egregious human rights abuses start at the top. The UN Human Rights Council created the fact-finding mission in September 2019. Its mandate was to investigate extrajudicial executions, enforced disappearances, arbitrary detentions and torture, and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment since 2014, laying the groundwork to ultimately hold those responsible to account. The findings in the UN report serve to underscore the need for a free and fair transition to democracy in Venezuela. It is the only way to end the suffering of millions of Venezuelans at the hands of the illegitimate regime of Nicolas Maduro and to deliver justice to the victims of the regime's horrific abuses. The United States is on the side of the Venezuelan people, who deserve to live without fear of violence from those who should protect and serve them, said Acting USAID Administrator John Barza in a statement. Interim President Juan Guaido and his interim government, members of the democratically elected National Assembly, Venezuelan civil society organizations, human rights defenders, and independent media all play a crucial role in keeping the fight for democracy alive in Venezuela. They are true heroes, said Acting Administrator Barza, and I am confident that they will prevail. The international community must unite in calling for free and fair presidential and parliamentary elections and the restoration of democratic governance in Venezuela. The United States looks forward to the day when it can celebrate the return of freedom to and respect for human rights in Venezuela.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.